It's time for Firearm Friday, a podcast dedicated to bringing together the firearm industry and community. Now here's your host, from the great state of Texas, the tactical leprechaun himself, Chris Dover.
Welcome to Firearm Friday. I am Chris Dover, and today we're going to be talking with Mr. Dave Kane from Kane Arms. Now, Kane Arms manufactures a wide variety of firearm accessories, from sling mounts to magazine extensions to forward grips and more. But first, let's talk just a little bit about Walther Arms. Now, Walther Arms should need no introduction, from the classic stylings of the PPK to the hot off of the assembly line PPQ Q5 steel frame. But what is sort of unique about Walther Arms is their try before you buy and money back guarantee. Yes, there is no risk in trying out one of the fine products from Walther Firearms. So get over there, check out what they have to offer. That's WaltherArms.com. All right, crew, help me welcome Dave with Kane Arms to the show. How are you, Mr. Dave?
I'm doing great, actually.
That's good. Good to hear. Great to hear. If you would, I guess before we get started, let's talk a little bit about your background. I mean, Kane Arms. Everybody can go check that out, of course, as we're talking here. KaneArms.com. That's Kane, C-A-I-N, Arms.com. And while everybody's doing that, I guess. What's the path that you led on? What's a little bit of your backstory that led you into Kane Arms and producing these different parts and accessories?
Back when I was in college, I was at University of Maryland, and I discovered 3D printing, and the technology was really it was new to me. It was very, very interesting, and I had a few ideas for different firearms parts, and I took them to a local shop. He was a machinist. He did all kinds of different things, but he also had a 3D printer, and so he printed off my design that I had done in a CAD program, because I was taking CAD classes at that time, and my idea went from just being, you know, a picture on the screen to being in my hand in an hour, and I didn't realize it at that point, but I was completely hooked on the technology. It amazed me, and later on, when things didn't quite work out with him, I ended up 3D printing the parts, and I ended up buying my own printers, and I ended up selling parts on eBay actually before I actually started the company. And then I got banned from selling on eBay because I was selling firearms parts.
Imagine that.
So I had yeah, go figure. So I had to start my own website, and it just snowballed from there. I went from having like a few parts to having 15 parts to having to upgrade my website subscription to having, I don't even know how many parts we have on the website now, and we're coming out with new parts every single day. So that's where it started.
Mm-hmm. Now, where do the ideas for the parts come from? Is that friends, people you know, or do you just kind of scouring the forums and the boards looking for you know, certain needs, or are you looking at other companies that make specific accessories and kind of designing your own, or how does a product design come about?
Well, initially, my very first product design was actually a sling mount that goes on the back of an AR-15 buffer tube, and it was actually kind of designed to be a replacement for the big, bulky, heavy pistol braces that you see on a lot of pistols these days. Mm-hmm. And we ran into a little bit of trouble with the ATF trying to get that, you know, okayed, and they actually came and confiscated some of our firearms to investigate them and things like that, but we ended up getting them back and everything was fine. But that was an original idea, and I almost had that patented until I realized that with the cost of patenting it and what it would be worth wasn't going to be worth the money at all. But since then, we've done a lot of parts, just like popular parts that you see on a lot of different firearms, a lot of magazine extensions, a lot of foregrips for your ARs, things like that. At this point, we have so many requests for parts that we can't even think of doing new parts of our own at this point. We currently have at least 5 different magazines or frames or gun parts sitting in one of the offices that people have just sent in that they want parts made for. So new parts is not an issue right now. It's just we're just trying to keep up with demand, which is actually becoming more and more difficult.
Right. Now that's new parts that they're wanting, like in their own, like a custom design, or
they either want a custom design, or they want a mag extension for a magazine that we don't currently make.
Gotcha.
Or currently we have a Gen 5 Glock 19 frame that was sent in, and somebody wanted a magwell for that. We haven't started on any of the magwells for the Gen 5s until now, and that's actually coming along really, really well. I'm actually excited about that. But yeah, it could be anything. But mostly it's a lot of the same stuff we're doing on the website right now, just new guns.
Right. Now, is on the manufacturing side of things, I'm sure there's folks listening that are completely familiar with 3D printing and the process and the materials. What I'm curious about is there different types of materials that you 3D print in? Is there different qualities of polymers or plastics or whatever is used? And which, where do y'all, if so, where do y'all fall as to what you guys use for your products?
That's actually a really good question. We use mostly one material. We have experimented with all kinds of things, from nylons to ABS to composite filaments. There are so many different types of filaments out there. There are even filaments now that you can run through a standard FDM, which is a filament deposit manufacturing printer, which is basically what we use most of the time. You can run metal filaments through them now, and you put them in a sintering furnace, and it literally like makes the entire part fully metal after you're done with it. Those are very, very, very expensive, but we generally use what's called PLA, or polylactic acid. It's a very, very standard plastic used in a lot of different manufacturing processes. They use it in gym water bottles. I can't even think of all that. It's used in a lot of different types of manufacturing.
Okay.
But when we started using it, we had some problems with it because it's very strong, it's very rigid, but it also can be very brittle. So we had to learn that it has to be heat treated after the parts are produced, but you can't heat treat them too much because then the actual measurements, the dimensions of the parts will change if you heat treat them too much. You have to find a happy medium, and you have to use a type of heat treatment that isn't going to warp it or change its dimensions. So it's been a learning process. Like when I got into this, I didn't know what I was getting into, which is probably a good thing, you know, good and bad. But I mean, like we've come a long way up to this point.
And what how many machines do y'all run there? Do y'all have a fairly big facility, or?
We currently have 7 or 8 machines that we're running.
Oh, wow.
Right now. Well, one's down for maintenance, but that's how many we have right now. And I was literally looking at buying some more today because right now during tax season is our busiest time. Everyone's spending their,
sure,
their tax returns, and so. We may need to buy some more machines very, very soon.
Well, you got to have people to run them too. That's
mm-hmm.
So you got to be careful with that, of course. No, I was just curious. You were talking about how things have been going well, and how you have all these orders and everything you've got to get out. I was just curious about the production time on what it does, what kind of time it takes to 3D print something, and then you threw me a loop. I was thinking about that question. I thought, well, I'm going to ask him how long it takes to, you know, 3D print a magwell, or, you know, whatever it might be, or a base plate or whatever. And then you threw me a loop with the whole, you know, the process afterward, right, that you had to heat treat it. So
mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that is printing done on an individual basis, or is there a technology where you can print multiple things at once?
You can actually do singles, you can do multiples. We have software that allows us to literally print whatever we want it to print, and you can change every single detail you want to. The thing that determines how long it takes to print a part is the layer height. So what you have to do is when you finished a part in a 3D CAD program like SolidWorks or anything like that. You then put that part, that 3D part, into a slicing program, and you determine how thick the layers are going to be, so it slices it into like 1,000 different layers.
Wow.
The thickness of the layers determines how long it takes to make the part. Now, we like to make the layers pretty thin so we get a very nice detail out of those parts. So our average, mag extension would probably take about 2.5 hours to do, and your average mag weld is about 45 minutes to an hour.
Wow. Okay. I'm sitting here thinking, wow, that seems like a lot of time.
Yeah, and that's one of the main downsides to 3D printing is it takes so much time. However, the main benefit of 3D printing, there are several actually. When you have something like a machine shop and you're doing what's called subtractive manufacturing, you start with a block of aluminum and you turn the machine on and you whittle it way down until you have your part. Mm-hmm. You have, unless you can melt that aluminum down again to reuse it, you have wasted the vast majority of the material that you had. Mm-hmm. Whereas with additive manufacturing, you literally only use the material that you need.
Right. Gotcha.
Now that's pretty significant. But also, when it comes to something like a 3D printer, the main reason that I ended up not going with a mold for my original part that I had come up with an idea for was because if I had a mold, it was going to take several tries to get it right, possibly. And every single time I did a mold, it was going to be about $2,000 to $4,000. And with a 3D printer, if you mess up a part, you just go back in and change the model and do it again, and then again and again and again, and you're out, you know, maybe a dollar at the end of the day. But with a mold, if it's incorrect, or if you have to redo it or change it or anything, you're out thousands and thousands of dollars every time. Mm-hmm. So with a 3D printer, it really, really helps with that whole process. And with a mold, you can only do one. You can literally do an infinite number of parts.
Sure, whatever you want to program it to do. And I'm guessing exactly. That there's more cost in the 3D machine up front, but then what you are able to get out of it versus the mold in the long term makes it the viable option, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Gotcha. Now, with the layer thickness that you were talking about, is there a structural benefit to going with a thinner layer? Or is it
not necessarily
an aesthetic thing? Okay. And so it's a more, like if you had, what am I thinking? Like serrations, Yeah, serrations or something like that on a part, or some of the finer pieces. I'm assuming, and we'll get into the products here in a little bit, but I'm assuming some of the magwells and stuff like that probably have some fairly thin portions to them.
Yes.
where they mount mm-hmm. up and stuff like that. So it gives you the flexibility. Now, I see that it says here made in the USA. Well, obviously it is, and it says using renewable materials. But what does that mean exactly with the renewable materials? I mean, plastics obviously can be reused, but are you guys able to reuse that, or do you have to send that off, recycle, and then put that back toward new raw material?
Well, the reason we can claim renewable is because the PLA that we use is actually derived from sugarcane, and it's a plastic that's biodegradable.
Wow. Okay. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Learn something new there. So
when I say biodegradable, if you take it out in the snow or the rain, it's not going to fall apart in your hands. It's not going to, you know, become soluble in water. It's not like that, but over time it will biodegrade, unlike something like aluminum or a polyurethane kind of polymer.
Yeah, so if you took it out into some a fairly wet area and buried it, you know, several inches deep for, you know, a couple of decades or something, is what you're saying at that point.
Yeah, eventually it would biodegrade, yes.
Yeah, right. Now, with your With colors, with your 3D printing, how does colors work with all of that?
Well, luckily, there are a slew of colors out there and different types of filaments that we can use. The problems we've run into is everyone wants our flat dark earth, our olive drab to match whatever company's part that they already have.
You and every other company, I think, gets that.
there's an Instagram page called 50 Shades of Flat Dark Earth, and it couldn't be more on point. We constantly get returns from people all the time because they say, oh, well, the dark earth didn't match my Glock frame, or their olive drab didn't match my Cerakote job. And it's like, and we literally have put a disclaimer on our color charts now that says, hey, all of our colors are proprietary. These are our colors. We cannot guarantee that they're going to match any other companies. Unfortunately, we could, but we really can't. When it comes to those two colors, for some reason, the amount of filaments we can find are very, very limited. Mm-hmm. So we've just done the best that we can.
Right. Well, a public service announcement for anybody out there that is concerned with their FDE or the OD colors. Here's a shocking announcement. I was using those colors long before they came cool, and so I've got accessories and other things that are quite old. And I will tell you firsthand, with age, they change color anyway. So. I've got several parts, and there it probably has to do with the quality of the material used, like you were talking about, or something like that over the years. But I've got some grips and some other things that no longer match the rifles, you know, for whatever reason. And it could be they could be absorbing oil from my hand, or you know, something like that, of course, and it changes the color on them too. What I'm curious about colors is, When you start a specific project, does the machines house a specific color and you have to clean that out to go to another color, or can you add different layers or different designs in with a different color during the production process?
Generally we just do solid colors. We have had some orders for multicolors. For instance, we actually did one that you'd like a lot. We did a Glock 9mm 40 cal 357 magazine extension with a text flag on the bottom of it.
Wow.
So what we did was we did the bottom layer in white, and then we did the rest of the extension in like a navy blue. So when the flag came out on the bottom, half of it was white, half of it was navy blue.
Oh, okay. Okay, I got you. That's interesting. So let's dive into a few of the products here. I've got the website up again for everybody out there listening. That's CainArms.com, CainArms.com, and the Glock boys are gonna love you. I mean, it's obvious because you've got a whole Glock section here. It seems like.
Absolutely, yeah.
But let's not talk specific, I guess, necessarily to any particular brand. Let's talk more about the products itself. But one of the things, and I've seen an Instagram post the other day, and I thought, wow, it's kind of boggling my mind how this thing even works. Is that magazine splice?
Yes.
That's interesting. Tell us a little bit about that magazine splice.
That was actually a request from a customer. I honestly didn't know anything about that until the customer contacted us, and they said, hey, this company called TACCOM or something like that had done this part previously, and either they pulled them off the shelves or they've just sold out so quickly you can never find them anywhere. Can you make one? And so I looked at it, and I watched the video on the installation. I said, oh, yeah, we could definitely do that. That's no problem. So we went ahead and we did a design. It probably took about 2 weeks to get it done and tested. And so it literally, you put the bases of the magazines in together, and you use the factory springs that came with the magazines. And so if you use, for instance, like most people do, like a Glock 17 and a 33-round 9mm magazine, it allows you to put in 47 to 50 rounds into that magazine.
Wow. So they're... Okay, so that's interesting. So that was what I was curious about. I was like, how does the feed ramp relay that off with the base plate of the other, you know, magazine or whatever? So you put them base plate to base plate, basically, and then it's one, it makes it one long spring, essentially.
Exactly, yep.
Okay. That's, yeah, that's definitely interesting. And right now that's just for Glock, I'm guessing, right?
Yes, the only one we've done so far has been for the Glock 9mm 40 cal and 357.
Gotcha. Now the magazine extensions, I know that's how I found you guys. I was looking, poking around looking for some magazine extensions for this Walther PPQ. And you guys are one of only a handful of companies that it looks like even makes those. The magazine extensions, are they all pretty standard as far as the added round capacity?
We try to keep most magazine extensions within the 141 millimeter specs for the USPSA pistol shooting competitions.
Gotcha.
And so we use a full-size magazine for that. And every company has a slightly differently sized full-size magazine. You know, some of them have 16 rounds, some of them have 18 rounds. So we just have a gauge and we use that, and whatever gets it to 141 millimeters, that's generally the length we go with.
Okay, I gotcha. Now I'm noticing here on the site there's some markings on the bottom of those magazine extensions.
Yes.
What is the relevancy of those? Is that something for y'all's benefit or?
No, that tells you, every single magazine extension tells you what magazine it goes on. So if, for instance, you ordered a CZ-75 magazine extension and a CZ-97 mag extension, mm-hmm. The one is going to say 75 and the other is going to say 97 on it. So that you know which one goes to which magazine.
Okay. The one I'm looking at here has a G and a lock, so I'm assuming that's Glock. And
yep.
Then a 943.
So that yep. Means the, so that stands for 9mm, 40 cal, and 357.
Okay. So it'll work for either of the three on a Glock is what that would mean.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Very cool. Yeah, I like that because, yeah, I mean, how many people are out there picking up mags and may pick up the wrong one? So that's that's never a good thing. And y'all have got, as far as the mag extensions, because I'm going through here and I see that you looks like you've got a stock extension for the Glock, and then you've got a PMAG extension. So, obviously, different designs on the floor plates. I'm guessing on those is the reason that had to happen.
Completely different. Yeah. Magpul, it's like Magpul goes out of their way to make their parts incredibly difficult to make aftermarket parts for.
Right. That's a pretty smart business move, though, right?
On their part, yes, it is.
At the end of the day, you know, it's not if they're not creating the products people want. I mean, that's an issue, I guess, that we have to, have to address mm-hmm. as well. And then I'm looking here on the Glock stuff, the magwells. I know those magwells have become a fairly big thing for most people.
Absolutely.
So what? What pistols do you guys make the magwells for? Is it just Glock at this point?
Mostly Glock. We do have a Canik TP magwell out right now. We're currently working, like I mentioned earlier, we're working on the Gen 5 Glock 19 mm-hmm. To make a magwell for that. But, I mean, we have a lot of people contact us on a regular basis. We attempted to make a magwell for the M&P full-size pistols, mm-hmm. but the way they designed those pistols and the way you have, if you've ever shot one of those, there's a small tool that sits in the back of the grip, and you pull the tool out and it not only allows you to change the back strap, but it helps you take down and disassemble the actual firearm itself. Mm-hmm. That tool gets in the way. So we actually, after doing a complete design for a magwell for that pistol, we realized that it was going to take so much modification to the frame that it wasn't even going to be worth it. Because most people want a part that they can just literally just bolt on mm-hmm. to their firearm. And if you're going to have to be drilling and tapping and removing this and changing that and sanding this, it's just not worth it after a while. So we actually decided not to go ahead and do that.
Right. And the Glock is just plug it in and one screw. It's pretty simple with that. The Canik, I'm not familiar with the Canik. How difficult is the magwell to install on that?
Luckily, it's about the same. You just pop it on and put in one screw. Some people are confused by the design because it's literally the screw just literally holding onto a lip. That's all it is to keep it in. But it works about the same way.
Okay, so it's not even through a hole like a Glock, what you're saying,
No,
right?
there's exactly, yeah. There's no designated hole for it. It just goes into a space that was in the gun that we designated as being, fit for holding it in place.
Right. Okay. Well, let's jump gears a little bit. Let's talk about some of this AR stuff. Starting with that sling mount. I mean, I've seen that and I thought, wow, that's neat. I mean, I'm not a big fan of the whole brace thing. Of course, I had SBRs before there were ever braces. So, I've gotten used to having that regular stock. But then I've seen this and I thought, it's simple, it's cheap. It's not, $200 plus or whatever for some of the nicer braces that are out there.
Yes.
And I thought, that could make it a little more comfortable to shoot, for sure. How do these attach? It looks like you have to change the buffer tube out, or what's the story with that?
We have a manufacturer that we get buffer tubes from, and then we drill them out and we tap them, or thread them so that they can accept a screw, so that you don't have to worry about the part ever coming off.
Okay.
But I mean, we also offer just the sling mounts by themselves. If you're handy, if you have a drill press, and if you want to get a tap and do it yourself. Mm-hmm. So.
Gotcha. That's what it looked like. So you slide it over the buffer, center your hole, drill it out, tap it, and you could actually put it on a pistol buffer or something like that if you so chose, right?
Yes. They're designed for standard pistol buffer tubes.
Okay. But if you've got an A2. I guess from what I'm reading here, it's just basically a bolt-on at that point, right?
Yes. The A2s, you literally just put them on, put the bolt in, and you're good to go.
Now, there's a couple of different versions here, it looks like. It looks like you've got the A2, AR-15 A2, and then the AR-15. So what's the difference there, other than looks like maybe one's a little thicker than the other? Or is the holes in a different place? I'm not real sure. I'm not following.
Okay. The A2 buffer tubes that are designed for the old standard A2 stocks, they have a center punched or a centered hole. And so like we just said with that one, you literally just put that one on, put the hole or put the screw in, and you're good to go. With the new ones, with the ones we did, they're proprietary because you have to drill an off-centered hole so that it doesn't move side to side at all. Yeah. And it stays vertical. And then once it's drilled, once it's tapped, then you put it on, then you put the screw in. And that'll be, like I said, a standard pistol buffer tube, which is much larger than your any other type of buffer tube, like your mil-spec buffer tubes, your commercial buffer tubes. The pistol buffer tubes are probably 0.04 inches thicker than those, and they're literally designed like that because, as you probably know with the ATF, if you have a pistol AR that can accept a stock that you have in your home, then that can be literally considered an SBR, and if you have another paperwork for it, they can literally prosecute you for that.
Right.
So that's why pistol buffer tubes are made significantly larger, so you can put that on your pistol, and there's no question as to whether or not you would be putting a stock on it.
Ah, okay. I got you now. That makes total sense. And I was thinking about that with the offset on the hole. I was thinking, yeah, that would make more sense because if it ever got loose, it would spin on you, it seemed like.
Exactly.
Potentially.
Yep.
So it being offset, it couldn't do that. Now with the, since I'm talking about a pistol, I've got... oh heck, what is it? Phase 5, I think, is the buffer tubes I've got. So, would this pistol sling mount bolt up to fit properly on a Phase 5, or do you know?
Now, the Phase 5 buffer tubes, I know they do have some buffer tubes out there that are like that are like hexagonal or octagonal, something like that. If it's the same diameter as your standard pistol buffer tube, it will still fit it.
Okay.
But if they have changed it completely, then it may not fit it.
Who knows? Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. And I guess if anybody's got any questions, I mean, they could probably measure and then email you guys and say, hey, it's this diameter. You know,
yes, absolutely. Yeah. We answer emails every single day.
And then y'all got the kit, too, as I'm scrolling down. So, you know, you could just break off a little more money and just do the whole kit and be done with it, right?
Absolutely.
And that may be the way to go, for sure. Moving on down the list here, you've got this, the PMAG display stand. This one kind of, occasionally I talk to people that have products, and it runs through my mind, and I know there's probably countless thousands of other people that's the same way, and I don't mean this bad, but why does the world need a PMAG display stand?
A PMAG, I'm sorry, which one are you looking at?
The PMAG display stand. The AR-15 PMAG display stand.
Oh, display stand.
Yeah.
I got you. Oh, that was actually a request from a customer, and we took it off the website there for a little while because it wasn't selling very much. Mm-hmm. But almost everyone has a PMAG. Everyone knows Magpul, so they're very, very common. They're a household name. So if you can just take your PMAG and throw it in the display stand, put your rifle on top of it, it just makes it easier if you want to put it up on the mantle or put it in a display box, anything like that. And so we recently put those back on the website because we were having requests for them.
Right. Well, there you go. Yeah, I mean, especially if you had a, you know, I was thinking, you know, and I always like to tease people with that. You know, why does the world need this? But I could see if you had, especially if you had something like a, if you had a high-end AR-15, you know, something that was, you know, Cerakoted to the max, you know, all pimped out or something like that. You don't want to just be leaning that up in the closet, you know, in the corner of the closet, or, you know, throwing it down on a range bench or, you know, something like that. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean,
We all have friends who have no clue about anything when it comes to firearms. So if you were to put like a standard AR-15 up on your mantelpiece, they would probably go nuts over it.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you've got some really cool. You know, we got some really cool foregrips. So I want to kind of finish up here talking about those, I guess, a little bit, because you've got several different ones. The what is the key lock gas pedal? I guess first of all, is that a type of a hand stop, or what is that exactly?
That was done as a request for a part that was based on a CZ. Foregrip that what you do is, it's kind of like if you've ever seen the gas pedals that go on the side of your Glock where you put your thumb on it and it holds the front down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It allows you that 45 degree angle, so you put your thumb on it and it keeps your barrel down in the front. That's what they call it, a gas pedal. It allows you to shoot a little bit faster because you can have better pressure on the top.
Okay, I got you.
As you're shooting.
Yeah, I've got one of those on a 17L and then also on a couple of Browning Buck Marks. They were called thumb rests with that. But that's what it looks like, honestly. That's what was kind of throwing me off. I'm like, is that a hand stop? What is it? But that makes perfect sense if you was to mount that, you know, and say if you were right-handed in, say, the 9 o'clock position on the rail, well, there you go. So, yeah, that's kind of cool. Now, the actual grips, and again, I'm looking at stuff here. Guys, on the canearms.com website, C-A-I-N, arms.com, and definitely go over there and check this stuff out, because I'm down to the foregrips, and very cool design on that. So kudos on the styling, I guess, on the aesthetic look of those foregrips. Those are kind of cool. What is the difference in the foregrips? I'm guessing length, angle, probably things like that.
Yes, absolutely. The reason that we started doing our own foregrips is because we couldn't find an angled foregrip that we liked. Well, I mean, not that we didn't like. We couldn't find one that we loved. And there are a lot of different companies out there with different foregrips. And the angled foregrips that they had were very, very bulky. And most of them were made in China. So we decided to do our own that had, its instead of a like more of a sharp angle on it. It was a curved angle so that you could use it more like a vertical grip the farther you pulled your hand back, giving you more diversity in what type of shooting you were going to be doing.
Right.
And then we went ahead and developed the vertical foregrips, and I mean we had requests for other grips, and that's where all those come from.
So the angled come first?
The angled, yeah, I think the angled was probably one of the very first we did, and then the little tiny hand stop was probably after that.
And another thing, I know you didn't mention it, as we've been talking about these parts, a variety of colors, correct?
Yes, every single one. We also have a custom color option on every single part that we do. We've had orders for hot pink. We've had orders for purple. We've had orders for glow in the dark. We've had orders for transparent. You name it, we have pretty much done it.
That's transparent. That's that's kind of weird. That gives a whole new meaning to ghost gun, I guess, doesn't it? Come on, but transparent. That could be a little dangerous. You know, having all transparent AR. You go to the range. You know, go down range to check your target. You come back, you can't find it. You know, that could be a bad thing. Now with the vertical foregrips, same thing on those. I know you got the LWRC. That's going to be for their proprietary handguards, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the that's the mini version of the foregrip, from what I'm looking at. And then you've got the mini and the gunfighter. So length difference on those is pretty much the only difference, or what are the differences in those two?
When you have the mini vertical foregrip is 2.5 inches long. We've actually never made a full-size vertical foregrip because we don't shoot like that, and we don't want to encourage people to shoot like that. If you're grabbing a foregrip with your entire hand, we personally believe that you're shooting the gun the wrong way. Now, we do understand that there are certain situations you might want to do that in, but that is not how any of us shoot. But the only difference between the mini vertical foregrip and the gunfighter vertical foregrip is there's a 5-degree angle on the gunfighter foregrip that allows you to use a slightly more comfortable C-clamp grip on your forend or on your handguard.
Oh, okay. Okay. Very interesting. But yeah, cool stuff. I'm digging the angle foregrip for sure. Several things I'm digging here. And you know, like we talked about the sling mounts there. That that whole kit. I'm kind of leaning toward that now instead of trying to mod my Phase 5. So yeah, you're giving me ideas for sure. Let's as we sort of finish up here, Dave. Let's talk a little bit if you don't mind. You guys are out of Maryland, of course, correct?
Yes.
And I'm sure we've got several listeners, viewers, whatever out there that seemingly complain all the time, and I don't blame them about the status of the Second Amendment, I guess you could say, with legislation and regulation and stuff like that in Maryland. So as far as the business climate goes, has that posed any issues for you guys? I know you talked about the sling mount and having to work around and do some things with the ATF, but as far as state level there in Maryland, is it fairly pleasant where you're at? I'm just kind of curious about the climate on the ground in the town, in the community, the area you're in, and then what the regulations are like, and if those hinder you guys in any way.
Absolutely. The gun laws in Maryland are absolutely atrocious, don't get me wrong, but operating in Maryland as an accessory manufacturer has not been bad. Now, Beretta was actually located in Maryland back in 2012, or actually in 2013, before the new gun legislation went into effect that really changed our entire gun culture. And Beretta ended up leaving the state because they were completely against it, and a lot of their own factory magazines and things like that were no longer compliant in Maryland, and they couldn't even be sold in Maryland. So it makes a lot of sense that Beretta left. Whereas we only manufacture accessories and nothing that's regulated, it's fine for us. We're actually located out on the eastern shore of Maryland on the Chesapeake Bay Peninsula. So we have Delaware, we have Maryland, and we have Virginia below us, south of us. Whereas where we are, there's a very big gun culture. There's a very big hunting and fishing culture. So in the community, most people are very, very excited about us. We have a lot of friends in the state police department, in the sheriff's department, a few city cops around here that just absolutely love us. Now, if we were on the other side of the bridge, closer to Washington, D.C. or Baltimore, I'm sure we'd have a very, very different experience with the community. But we're lucky to be located where we are.
I got you. So nothing with as bad as the regulations and the legislations and all of that is with Maryland. You're saying nothing y'all make. Everything y'all make can be sold, can be owned. I guess would be the word, right? So there's no restrictions on any of that, then, right?
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there who don't understand their own state laws. Mm-hmm. I know Connecticut and California have some very, very strict laws, and there are a few other states as well as municipalities like cities like Chicago that have very, very strict laws.
Sure.
And we get a lot of people from like New Jersey and California who email us and they say, hey, we're not allowed to have more than 10-round magazines. Can you make us extensions that don't extend the capacity? And we have done that many times for a lot of different people. But what a lot of people don't understand is, especially here in Maryland, even though we cannot buy or sell magazines that are over 10 rounds here in Maryland, it is legal to own. It is completely legal to own. And the fact that they would even in California, as far as I understand, there's a law about owning magazines that were manufactured after a certain date. If your magazine was manufactured after a certain date, you're not allowed to own it if it's a full capacity magazine, for instance, like a Glock 17 magazine.
Right.
Now, the joke to me is you can't reinforce that law.
Yeah.
It's exactly. It's completely unenforceable. So when people from California contact us and they say, hey, can you do this for me? I almost want to be like, you don't understand. Like you can own full-sized magazines because they're not regulatable. Now, I understand people want to abide by the laws and they don't want to put themselves in a position where they ever could be prosecuted for something if there was like a serial number on a magazine that you could trace back, you know, the production date or anything like that. I understand. But it's almost frustrating to me that people don't dig deeper into their own personal laws. Because here in Maryland, I was talking to a man who was claiming to be a sheriff's deputy, a retired sheriff's deputy, and I told him that I made mag extensions for firearms. And he said, oh, well, you're not allowed to own that in Maryland. And I don't know if he was a sheriff's deputy or not. My red flags went up. I think he may have been bull crapping, if you will.
But
No, he was completely wrong, and I had to set him straight. And I was like, look, I don't know how long ago you retired, but I have 50-round magazines at my house, and it's perfectly legal for me to have these. I shoot with police officers on a regular basis.
Right.
So it's very, very important. Wherever you live, be very familiar with your legislation. And granted, legislation is changing, especially in Maryland, on a regular basis.
Right.
But please familiarize yourself with your local laws, what you can and cannot do, and what is and is not enforceable.
Right. And you know, and sadly, like the California legislation, and I know Connecticut's that way. You know, New York has some of the same things in Chicago, like you talked about. You know, they write it in such a language a lot of times that people just don't understand it. I think they do go legitimately try to look up the regulations, but then they go through it, and it's Greek.
I do understand that too, yes.
You know, and for that I would say, you know, you make a great point, because a lot of times people say, well, if you don't understand it, go have somebody in law enforcement. Not really. you gotta be careful with that too, as you kinda pointed out. You know, I think one of the best places, and this gives us an opportunity to point people in the right direction, might be, you know, look for your state level Second Amendment organization. Those are usually a good place to go. They usually, because they deal with that, right, on a regular basis. They're
absolutely
at your state capitals, and they're fighting the anti-gun legislation, and they're trying to push through the good stuff and all of that. So they're very versed and very familiar in all of that stuff. So those are the people that I would advise you go to if you have issues and questions like that. Well, it looks like we are about out of time here, Dave. So Before we split, real quick, I'll let you kind of give your little spiel there. Let folks know where they can get a hold of you guys if they have any issues, if they want to, you know, questions, whatever, if they want to just look at the products. What's the best way to do that?
Absolutely. We do everything through the website. So we have a contact page on the site at canearms.com. That's, like you said before, CAINArms.com. If you ever have any problem with anything, you just reach right out to us. We have great customer service, and we back our products up 100%. Every single part comes with a one-year warranty. So if there's any kind of bridge, if a screw strips out, we will replace it, no problem, no questions asked, as long as we can verify that it happened.
Right.
Gotcha. And, yeah, I will speak real quick to your Instagram, which Instagram I think has been down most of the day today. I don't know what happened with that. So if you can't get over there and check that out today, definitely go do it. You guys have a pretty good Instagram feed over there. A lot of cool guns all accessorized up and that sort of thing. So, yeah, definitely go check out the Kane Arms Instagram. So, Dave, thanks for joining me. And, yeah, keep in touch. And if you guys come out with newer products and stuff like that, let's get you back in. Let's get you back in the house here and talk about them.
Absolutely. That sounds great.
Thank you for joining in on another Firearm Friday. Don't forget to log on to clovertech.com. There you'll find our social media links, the blog, cool swag, and more. If you'd like to help support our projects and take advantage of some extra perks, you can do so over on Patreon at patreon.com/clovertech. Have a great weekend.